Clerk will call the case. Counsel.
May please the court, counsel. A criminal response to unlawful police conduct is certainly not a defense to any crime that is, I mean, is not a defense to, I'm sorry, let me put it this way. A criminal response to unlawful police conduct cannot justify evidence that is seized as a result of that response. Now, you may be wondering, if I concede that, then why am I here? Because what happened below is that the court did just that. The court suppressed evidence on the grounds, it appears, that the officer had neither probable cause nor reasonable suspicion to justify ordering the defendant, in this case, to open his hand and show him what was in his hand. But the research in the area indicates that to suppress the evidence would not bode well for any community. And I think in the ICA's concurring opinion, they point out, and I think effectively and dramatically, the situation where a defendant shoots two police officers, one who dies, the other survives, and if we were to say that if that was in response to an unlawful police encounter and we suppressed the evidence, then of course in that case the criminal would go free. And the problem would be if nobody would agree with that. Nobody in their right mind would agree that in that set of circumstances the evidence ought to be suppressed. But then the problem is, how do we draw the line? If we are to have a rule of law, it would have to apply to everyone. I am here nevertheless because my position is that when the court below suppressed all of the evidence in this case, it effectively ended this case. It was, in essence, no different than a dismissal. And my position is it was the right thing to do, although for the wrong reasons. Kachanian and the court's more recent opinion in State versus Line applied to the situation where the unlawful police conduct generated a criminal response. Kachanian, I'm sure this court is well aware, resulted in the defendant in that case fighting back with the police in response to an unlawful seizure. And of course, in the Line case, the mother in that case resisted an unlawful search, and the court had held that the entry of the house, I should say, was unlawful, would give the mother no defense to what the police did in that case. And I think that we go back to the policy is, if you folks did that, then we'd all be in trouble, I suppose. But those cases do not apply to a case such as this. This is a case where you have, and I don't think even the state would argue that the officer's conduct in this case was in any way legal. There was neither probable cause nor reasonable suspicion. But the response is what we ought to focus on. The response of the defendant in this case, Mr. Edgerlin, I respectfully submit, was not criminal. It was certainly a troubling response, and people may disagree with how he responded. But I think we need to focus on all of the circumstances so that we can say why the response of Mr. Edgerlin was not criminal. He was, of course, charged with terroristic threatening in the first degree, both because the officer was a public official, that is clear, that is conceded, and because there was, let's say for the purposes of this argument, a knife in the hands of the defendant.
Mr. Jameson, can the circuit court dismiss a criminal, I'm not sure in this case whether it's an indictment or complaint?
Can they dismiss an indictment or complaint? I believe, yes, they can, if there are sufficient reasons to do so, if there is no probable cause. And my position is this. Had there been a motion to dismiss the, in this case it was a complaint because it went by way of preliminary hearing, then I think if you examined what happened at the prelim and what happened, and if you took what happened at the motion to suppress evidence as being the record in the case, then I think the court would properly have dismissed the charges, the charge of a terroristic threatening in the first degree because there was no probable cause. And I would like to focus
now
on the fact.
This case, I'm sorry, Lyon came out after your case, but there was no motion to dismiss for lack of probable cause filed.
Not in Lyon, there wasn't.
Well, in this case also.
Oh, in my case as well, that's correct.
So that would have to be based on some defect at the preliminary hearing?
And I would, if we went back to the preliminary hearing, the defect would be the evidence that was presented at the preliminary hearing, which was essentially what was presented at the motion to suppress, with some slight differences. And I would submit that the differences between what was presented at the prelim and what was presented at the motion to suppress was not so different that it would result in a finding of probable cause. Basically, the facts were these. What was shown in the light most favorable to the state was this. Officer Cal Miller, if I may summarize the facts briefly, first was drawn to what the defendant was doing simply because the defendant happened to be walking at a rapid pace up a hill that the officer thought he couldn't walk. He said he often walked the beat, and it wasn't easy to walk the hill in the way he saw the officer doing it. He didn't stop defendant doing that. Now, I can see he didn't stop the defendant because of that, because apparently what the officer continued to do is he saw that, thought that was odd, then he parked his car. Now, the same person he saw turns up in the parking lot. He sees that person, Mr. Edgerlin, walk towards a security guard, do an about face, and walk into the Safeway Market. Now, because it sounds like from the evidence presented that because of the tattoos, the chains, the late night, the area of a lot of break-ins into cars and so forth, the officer on that basis thought he might be looking at someone who might be in the act of or about to commit a shoplifting. And this is all in the record. So he gets out of his car and he walks to the door, and as he's looking through the door, apparently, the defendant is on his way out. Officer Miller walks through the door that can only open inward. It's an automatic sensor door. He walks the door open, and Officer Miller looks to one of the Roy, I can't remember his name right now, but one of the store workers for some confirmation maybe that, in fact, the officer was right. But he doesn't get that. He gets the opposite. What he gets, the record shows, is the store employee goes, no. So now the officer has nothing. Now what he does next is troubling because he puts himself, he walks directly up to the defendant with no reason to believe that the defendant has committed or was about to commit a crime. Had he seen a knife before he ever approached the defendant, I would concede he would have had a right to do so. But he saw something in the defendant's hand and he couldn't say what it was. He said at the hearing, he thought he wanted to see if the person had stolen something. That's why he commanded him to open his hand. When he commanded the defendant to open his hand, it was the officer who put himself within an inch of the defendant. When the defendant complied, and one could quibble with this, one could say, there are different ways to say what's in my hand. You could say, I have a knife in my hand. You could do this. Or you could do what the defendant did in this case, which was, in the words of the officer, he canted it upward. Now, canted it upward, I would respectfully submit, is showing him what's in his hand. That the officer felt threatened was not due to anything the defendant did. Yes, the defendant was less than was within inches of the officer apparently when he did that. But it wasn't the defendant who caused that. It was the officer who put himself right in front of that knife. Now, when the officer, as one would expect, stepped back quickly and drew his revolver, you have no evidence that the defendant pursued the officer. He stood where he was, and the evidence is with the knife still in his hand, canted slightly perhaps, but I would submit it is, and there is conflicting evidence on that, but he does so, I would submit, because one moment he's about to leave the store, and in the next moment there's a police officer right in his face, right up against him. And then when he shows the officer what's in his hand, the officer steps back, and I would infer from the record that the officer immediately began to tell him several times to drop the knife, but I don't think it was like, drop the knife, drop the knife, drop the knife. The inference is that the officer would have said, drop the knife, drop the knife, drop the knife. You have to give, now people will respond differently depending on who you are, depending on the circumstances. The point is, this defendant did comply. He may not have complied the way you or I may have complied, but he complied. The record is clear. The record is clear. What the defendant did next was comply by, you can, for the sake, semantically you could say he threw the knife at the officer because the officer was where, sort of where he threw the knife. The more proper way to characterize it is, he tossed it to the side of the officer, because that is what the facts show.
Mr. Jameson, if I could, you're really kind of arguing whether the defendant engaged in the offense of terroristic threatening.
That's what I'm arguing.
But that would be a good, those will be very good arguments for the jury, could be good arguments for a jury, but in terms of the suppression motion, the question is whether that there was, in fact, an unlawful stop, which the state concedes there was an unlawful stop, and then whether that taint was in some way attenuated by the subsequent circumstances. That's where the Intermediate Court of Appeals hung its hat on the notion that at some point, whatever happened initially in the initial approach was attenuated by the state's version of what happened in this incident, and I think the officer's testimony would put a different slant on it from that which you've argued. I guess my question to you is, first of all, as a preliminary matter, did the state, in fact, preserve the argument that it ultimately made before the ICA and prevailed on, which is that there were intervening circumstances that eliminated the taint? Because as I went back and looked at the argument on the motion to suppress, the state's arguments were directed entirely to the notion that this was, in fact, a lawful stop, either because there was probable cause or because there was reasonable suspicion to do a Terry stop. That's how the argument on the motion to suppress, or that's how the motion to suppress was argued. It wasn't until a hearing very late in the proceeding, right before the appeal was taken, that the issue that ultimately came up of whether there was an attenuation of taint was raised very briefly by the prosecutor. So my question to you is, was this issue that ultimately the ICA ruled on even preserved by the state?
Thank you. I would say probably not, because if the state bringing it up at the motion to clarify what was suppressed did not comply with the requirement that proper notice be given to the other side so that a response can be made. So in that sense, it was improper to raise it, and I would submit the court, if he chose to ignore the argument, could do so. So that's my argument on that. But I do. And I don't mean to beat a dead horse. It's just that I wanted to so strongly emphasize that Kachanian and Lyon are good cases. They're good cases. But they do not apply here because we're not talking. And I know you folks, because maybe we ought to send it back to for maybe further hearing on whether or not there was sufficient probable cause. But my question would be respectfully, you have before you a record already of the preliminary hearing, and you have.
Jameson, I guess you could argue that the defendant threw the knife at the officer or threw the knife to the side of the officer, right?
I think the facts are clear. He threw it to the side. There's no dispute on that.
Okay, so throwing it to the side, you could maybe argue that that was an attempt to threaten the officer, or you could argue it was in compliance with the officer's...
Did you say somebody could argue it was an attempt to throw it at the officer?
Yes, or you could argue it was an attempt to threaten the officer.
I would disagree with that.
You would, okay.
And the reason I would is because...
Could you also argue that it was an attempt as you have contended, that it was in compliance with what the officer had asked? That is, show me what's in your hand or what's in your hand.
I would argue that is what the evidence showed. And if I could continue, it is because if you examine the circumstances...
What inference we can draw from that conduct, who should be making that decision?
Generally speaking, the fact finder below should be making that decision.
And in this particular case, for purposes of what that conduct represented, should it be the judge at the motion to suppress, or should it be the jury at the trial on the charge?
On the issue of whether or not it was threatening conduct, it should be the jury. Because on the motion to suppress, as I said, the problem here is this. Let me rephrase this. Even at a motion to suppress, I suppose, okay, and this is what is so confusing here. And I actually thought about arguing this to you folks, so maybe I'll just toss it out there anyway, because light hasn't come on. But I know that probable cause is not the same thing as jurisdiction. But when there is no probable cause for that a crime was committed, I don't know of any court in any state that would say we have any business hanging on to the case, regardless of whether we're hearing a motion to suppress or whether or not it's a question of whether he threw the knife or not. If a court sitting and looking at a set of facts sees plainly from those facts there appears to have been no probable cause here, the case should end right then and there. It should just end there, because you would, if you do not end that case there, you end up holding somebody in custody in the absence of probable cause.
If the defendant had not tossed the knife but just opened his hand and the officer arrested him for an offense, say, for example, for carrying a concealed weapon, would the knife then be suppressed?
For carrying a concealed weapon?
Yes.
In response to an officer's order to open his hand? Yes, the knife would be suppressed. Under the circumstances here, you're saying that he walks into the store, doesn't see what's in the hand, and walks right up to his face and then says, open your hand?
Yes.
For carrying a concealed weapon? Yes.
So in this situation, though, when the defendant tosses a knife in the direction of the officer, is that something different from merely opening his hand? Is that conduct something distinct from merely opening his hand and showing the officer or complying with the officer's request?
I would say no. He is complying with the request.
Could two reasonable people looking at that toss come to different conclusions as to what the intent of the defendant was?
I don't mean to say it's a trick question, but I mean to say that two reasonable people looking at what you have stated to me would need to know more, I would expect. And that's what I was getting at. Because, had the officer in any way testified, it hit him, or I had to take evasive action, it would be an entirely different case. But the officer did not do so. The officer may have hedged and may have hemmed and may have hawed, but the fact is he never had to take any evasive action. So someone looking at this and he had to decide, was he throwing it at the officer and threatening at him, or under the circumstances when he was told, to drop it, and he tossed it to the side of the officer with no evidence the officer had to take evasive action, I would assume that reasonable, and maybe I shouldn't assume this, but I would hope that reasonable people would say, no, this is not a threat. This is compliance. He didn't throw it at the officer. The officer didn't say he had to dodge out of the way. He didn't say it almost hit him. He didn't say it did hit him. He said, drop the knife, and the defendant threw it towards the side of the officer. And I would submit even this. If I was the officer, I would rather, in a sense, have the knife closer to me than close to the defendant.
Mr. Jamis, if I could follow up on Justice Acoba's question regarding the effect or consequence if the defendant was ordered by the officer to open his hand and reveal the knife. You thought if that was all that was here, then that should be suppressed if all the defendant did was comply with the officer's command. In fact, at the same hearing we were talking about earlier, it's my understanding that the deputy prosecuting attorney said the state does concede that the court did properly suppress the evidence, to wit, the knife, that the officer did illegally search the defendant by demanding him to reveal what was in his hand. After that, he revealed a knife. Now, did you understand that to be a concession by the state in the circuit court that the knife itself should be suppressed, although subsequent actions of the defendant involving the knife perhaps shouldn't be suppressed? And if so, is the state's position now inconsistent with that? And was the ICA's opinion, which completely vacated the suppression order, inconsistent with that concession?
It seems that the state's position is somewhat inconsistent. It seems that the ICA's position would be inconsistent. It would seem that they ought to suppress maybe the knife at least, but not the officer's observations. And I had thought of offering that as sort of a compromise in this case, but I'm out of my 20 minutes, so maybe I better save that.
Initially, you indicated that when the officer approached the defendant, I thought you said you used the word canted.
The officer used that word, so I was repeating what the officer said. So
the officer indicated that the knife was faced at him. He didn't just merely open his hand.
No.
Is that right?
Right. The hand was, my understanding of the facts are, if my sleeves were longer, it was something like this. The officer couldn't see what was in the hand. Not until he said, show me what's in your hand, and the officer, then the defendant did this.
Okay. No, then he did this. The concurring opinion indicates that the argument was that the knife was faced at the officer's stomach, right? Pointed at the officer.
Yes,
now,
it did.
That is somewhat consistent with terroristic threatening, if you interpret that to mean a threat to harm the officer, correct?
Again, like a lot of things in law, it seems to me that to answer something sufficiently and reasonably, instead of just speaking in those narrow terms, we'd have to look at more.
I understand what you're saying. I mean, we'll look at it more, but just this one aspect of it.
In this case, yeah. No.
The aspect of the knife being pointed and faced at the officer's stomach, could you interpret that as meaning a threat to harm?
If you're asking in general.
Yes, just in general.
In general, yes, let's say in general.
Did the trier of the fact here, in this case, make that determination?
I believe in his findings of fact, Judge De Rosario did mention that the knife was pointed at the officer's stomach.
I don't think so. Just assume that the finding of facts did not include that one specific description. Okay. He didn't indicate, I don't recall him stating in his finding of facts or statement of facts that the knife was actually pointed at the officer. In his oral statement, I think he had indicated in the hearing that the knife had been pointed towards the officer, but he said nothing about being pointed to the officer's stomach.
Thank you. I may have been confusing the oral findings with the written findings.
Okay. Do you agree that in a motion to suppress in this type of hearing that you could, as a matter, the judge could, as a matter of law, determine what the facts are?
Yes.
Okay. In this situation, there is a argument as to what actually took place in terms of the pointing of the knife, the throwing of the knife, the throwing of the sock with the coin. Somebody said that it went flying by the officer and hit the window, the sock with the coin.
Yes.
Somebody else said it had fallen to the ground close to where the knife was, which was a foot away from the officer in a basket.
I believe the coins fell between the basket and the window.
It was in a similar area. It was supposedly flung or tossed.
By the baskets, to the right of the officer, yes.
So the judge did not determine. The judge determined that the sock with the coins landed next to the officer's foot to the side and not hitting the window.
Well, it hit the window, then it hit the floor. What are you asking me?
The judge said in his finding of facts.
No, that's what a witness said. You're right. It landed by the officer, correct.
I guess what I'm getting at is if there's a dispute as to the facts, you've got two witnesses who said, the employees that said that they didn't see him point the knife at the officer. They
right.
didn't see him say anything of the words that Miller said.
That's right.
And if this is in the findings of facts or absent certain allegations of flinging the sock with the coins and hitting the window and pointing the knife at the officer's stomach, if those things are absent,
I would say they're rejected.
And the judge is to try out the fact.
He is.
And he could, as a matter of law, determine what the facts are at that point.
Yes.
Assuming that the court found that the defendant was acting in compliance with the officer's orders, and if that's the case, then there would not, well, you would think, there wouldn't be sufficient evidence to prove terroristic threatening. How does the court come to make a decision like that?
Well, I'm not
the sufficiency of evidence to prove a crime.
Well, I'm not a judge, but I'd look at it this way. If I was a judge in this case, and I had before me evidence that there was compliance with the officer's request, and it was in the context of a motion to suppress evidence, I would let the parties know that I'm considering dismissing it on the grounds that there is insufficient probable cause to let them enlighten me further, and tell them that I was inclined on my belief of what I see in this case to dismiss it. So if you think, Mr. Prosecutor, or Ms. Prosecutor, I should not, then find me some law or give me some argument that my finding of fact in this case is wrong or that I shouldn't do this. That's what.
Anderson, is your argument that at a motion to suppress, where they only put on evidence regarding the Fourth Amendment, that the judge should then take it and dismiss it without a complete record?
The reason I hesitate is because of this. What does a judge do in the context of whatever we call the hearing? If the judge truly believes as a officer, a representative of the law, someone who wants to implement the law, that whatever we label this thing that's in front of the judge, we're talking about a situation where it appears to this judge in what he knows about the law and what he sees before him, that if this thing were to continue any further, he's holding somebody in custody that should not be in custody. In that context, I would say the court should rule the court should deal with the problem then and there. Maybe if the prosecution says, Judge, give us some time to respond, I think the court, because we can all be wrong, the court should, yes, the prosecutor should have an opportunity to show, Judge, you're catching us by surprise. But should the judge ignore what the judge sees? Because I'm assuming the court is would be rightfully concerned in a criminal case if someone is being held without sufficient basis, and not have to worry about whether the label of the hearing, what we label the hearing that's before the judge. That's why my response is the court ought to rule. Otherwise, the court sits there and does nothing while the court truly believes on the law and the facts that this person is being wrongfully held.
So you're saying the court plainly erred by not sua sponte dismissing the case even though the defendant never moved to dismiss?
In this case, the facts appear to be so clear. One could make that argument. Sorry, my time is up. Although you folks can make me stay if you want to.
Please the court. Good morning. Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Brian Vincent on behalf of the State of Hawaii. As I was listening to the counsel's presentation here, I think identified three issues that you're concerned about. The first one is, did we, the state, preserve error at the trial level? The second one was, can this motion to suppress be interpreted as a motion to dismiss and ruled upon as such? And whether or not, and I think the other one was, whether or not, if, assuming there's illegal detention, and assuming that, say, the knife in this case was illegal to possess in itself, could that be suppressed, yet the threat with a knife not be suppressed? And I'll deal with those in that order. First one is, did we preserve error? And let me quickly go over the procedural posture here. I believe it was November 7th, 2007, we had defendant filed a motion to suppress. And then on November 7th, we had an evidentiary hearing on this. November 21st, the circuit court made its oral findings of fact. And then I believe I think it was February 11th, the court filed its written order granting defendant's motion to suppress evidence and statements. Okay. Now, at that point, I think we didn't have any problems with the findings of fact and the conclusions of law as such, okay? And in fact, we conceded that, okay, that it wasn't an unlawful detention. What we wanted to clarify was the scope of the motion to suppress. And particularly, we wanted to know whether or not we could use the officer's observations of the alleged terroristic threatening against the as evidence in a trial against him. Okay, and I think we've also here at this point, the state conceded that the knife itself was suppressible. Now I'm taking a position contrary to that now, and I think that the ICA took a position contrary to that when it issued its opinion.
Counsel, that concession is not binding in some way on the state?
I would say in this case not, and I would argue not, because I don't think that concession influenced the circuit court's ultimate decision in this case. The circuit court suppressed everything, okay, even the officer's observations. So I don't think the concession didn't lead the circuit court into error. And that's what I would argue.
Did this, and
it was erroneous.
Excuse me. The concession came before the appeal.
That's correct. This was at the hearing on March 7th.
And on appeal, did you change that position? Is that right?
I argue that both the knife and the officer's observations are admissible into evidence. I wasn't really thinking about that issue at the time, so I just argued it generally. Okay. And then the other issue is was the state's arguments at this March 7th, 2008 hearing, was that sufficient to preserve the error? And in our position that it is, the trial deputy said that, argued, the state's position here, and I'll read her argument. The state's position is therefore that when the defendant held the knife in a threatening manner and failed to disarm himself, even though he was at gunpoint, that certain independent intervening factors arose which attenuated the taint of the illegal search. I think at that point the trial deputy had cited Kachanian. I think that it would have been clear to the court, but I don't think we always, at the trial level, we always have as much time to do the research as we do here at the appellate level. So,
this argument, excuse me, was made at the motion to suppress?
This was made at the motion, at the hearing to clarify the motion to suppress.
So throughout, you'd agree that throughout the motion to suppress, this argument was not raised by the state?
We argued that the trial deputy argued that the detention was not illegal.
So we get through that, we get a written order, and now the time to appeal apparently was looming. And I believe there was a motion to dismiss also, actually, by that point,
mm-hmm.
Mr. Briner, the defense counsel. And so we're at after a off-the-record chambers conference, we're now in front of the court asking for clarification about the order. And it's your position that the deputy, by alluding to this argument in that context, that was enough to preserve the issue?
That's correct. And the circuit court did not want to reconsider at that point. So,
would it be difficult for the circuit court to pick up a new issue after the motion to suppress was finished?
I think that the circuit court could have issued an order clarifying its prior order, certainly.
Oh, was this clarification in relation to a new theory raised on the motion for clarification?
It was a new theory. If you look back at the motion, at our memo on op, the motion to suppress.
Counselor, if you look at it, I think the issue of attenuation is raised, although it's argued that it's argued that the court needn't go there because the initial stop.
That's correct. Yeah, that's correct. That's a fair characterization, I believe. So,
Wouldn't have been more appropriate for the state to file a motion to reconsider, or in some way give, to be fair to the trial court, give it the opportunity to consider what is a very significant and new theory in the case, rather than alluding to it briefly in an argument that the court understood was simply to clarify the scope of its ruling? Is that fair to the court?
Well, I think it would have been better. Better policy to file a motion to reconsider. I think that orally bring it to the circuit court's attention is sufficient, though, and that's our position here today.
Presumably, you could have moved to reopen the hearing.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. That's correct. I think we looked at the motion as I examined it in appeal, and I looked at the order, and I couldn't find anything that was clearly erroneous
or
a wrong conclusion of law.
Mr. Vincent, has the defendant ever raised the failure to preserve the issue on appeal?
No, the defendant has not.
Okay.
Yeah, not at the IC, and I don't believe on the application for cert either.
I'm sorry. If you found nothing erroneous, then you would have to agree that the court was correct when it said that in compliance with the officer's order, the defendant displayed the knife or revealed the knife.
I would argue that the findings of fact, as far as they go, are not clearly erroneous. But I think that if this
so
was...
That means he was complying at the time that he exposed the knife. He was complying with the court's order? The officer's order?
I would say when the defendant opened his hand and revealed the knife, that was a compliance to the court, to the officer's order. But the officer testified at trial, at the hearing. He said, here on page 42 of the transcript, November 7th hearing. Right?
Counsel, may I just step back one step? Did you challenge the findings of fact on appeal?
I did not. I did not because as I said, as far as the findings of fact on appeal go, they are not clearly erroneous.
So they're binding on this court. Would you agree with that?
As far as they go, Your Honor.
If you think there was a material omission, wouldn't it be incumbent upon you to have challenged the findings of fact to raise that omission? Or otherwise waive it?
If I were appealing a motion to dismiss, say for de minimis, or for motion to dismiss for insufficiency of evidence, I would have asserted that there were findings of fact that were not made, or that there was clearly erroneous that they did not make certain findings of facts. But this, as I said, this was a motion to suppress, and that was the procedural posture.
Why would it be different? Why, because it's a motion to suppress, should you be relieved of your obligation to challenge findings or else be bound by them?
Because I don't think anywhere in circuit court, I don't think that the defendant anywhere alerted the state that this was a motion to dismiss for insufficient evidence.
Wholly apart from that, you were appealing the motion to suppress. There are certain factual findings in the motion. When you filed your opening brief, you did not challenge those findings. And accordingly, as I understand our case law, those findings are binding upon this court. And there are, if there were a material omission, would you not have been obligated to either raise it or be bound by it?
I would argue that I can't anticipate an argument that has not been made in the sense that
you're bound by the findings because you're bound as far as your theory on appeal is concerned because that theory was not tried at the motion to suppress.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
So therefore, the theory you raise is raised late.
Well, with respect to...
The court never had an opportunity to consider it. The witnesses apparently were not examined pursuant to this theory, and the defense never had an opportunity to defend against this theory at the motion to suppress.
Well, and it goes the other way as well. Okay? There was a witness, okay, in this case that was not available at the hearing. Okay, one of the clerks, I believe. Okay, she didn't come to testify, and I'm confident that she would testify at trial if the case was taken to trial.
Yeah, but does that have anything to do with your theory that there is an attenuation of the illegality of the stop and therefore you have a distinct and different crime?
Was there an offer of proof as to what that particular employee was going to be testifying to that would be consistent with your theory of the case?
Memo in opposition, we included her HBD 252 statement, I believe, in there. And that was the one thing that was not stipulated to at the hearing on the motion to suppress because she was not there.
So there was no offer of proof.
Well, our offer of proof would have been that she would have testified.
Is there an offer of proof before the judge?
The judge
at the time of
no,
the
no.
Yeah.
No. But in any case, okay. Let me move on to the next topic here, if you have no more further questions on that topic. Again, this is not a motion to suppress. It's
Counsel, could I just wrap up one last thought
mm-hmm.
the issue about waiving by not challenging the findings of fact? The trial court here, as the Chief Justice pointed out, in its oral ruling appeared to indicate that the knife was pointed at Officer Miller. Defendant opened his hand, raised a knife that he was holding, and pointed towards Officer Miller while backing up. That didn't make its way into the written order, which you then did not challenge in your appeal. So are we bound by the written order's version, or should we reach out and look to the oral ruling or the record?
Well, I suspect that the reason why that this... I suspect that the reason why that the oral ruling didn't make it into the written ruling is because the judge did not think it was relevant to the suppression issue, and not because the judge did not believe it was true.
Or it could be there was
just
a conflict.
Believe the officer.
It could also be there was a conflict in evidence, and the judge chose to believe one version of it.
That's correct.
Because there was testimony that the two of the Foodland, or was it Safeway, I'm not sure, employees didn't see the defendant point the knife at the officer, but that he flipped it on their hand to the side of the officer.
That's correct. But I would submit that the evidence that's going to appear at trial, if this case goes to trial, is different. There's going to be additional evidence at a trial than there was here at this hearing because of the limited nature of this hearing. It was focused on one particular issue. The evidence was adduced to support our position on that issue, and there was no indication at that point in time that this was a motion to dismiss for de minimis or insufficient evidence or whatever you will. So I guess that covers those first two topics. The last topic was an interesting one, and the defendant has conceded here that the post detention observations and evidence are admissible, but. Question was raised is whether or not, if the knife itself was illegal, let's say it was a butterfly knife, which is prohibited under, possession of which is prohibited under, I think, HRS 134-51, but would that butterfly knife be admissible proving that crime, and of course the facts aren't here in front of us right now, but it's an interesting question and can be addressed. I think that one of the cases that was cited by the concurring opinion, ICA, indicated that it wouldn't be suppressed. I think it was the Bailey decision where I think the officer accosted the defendant in the airport. Defendant ran. They arrested the defendant and pursuant to a search incident to lawful arrest, they discovered drugs. Okay, they ruled the drugs were not inadmissible because he had committed a subsequent crime to the illegal detention and therefore that attenuated the taint of the illegal detention. Because that question isn't before the court, I think it's an open question, and I maybe would save my arguments on that for later. But I would argue that definitely in this case, there was no... The butterfly knife is not illegal in and of itself, okay? And it's only illegal in the sense that it, in the manner that it was used by a defendant after the event of the illegal detention. So it would be I think an intolerable rule to require the suppression of this kind of evidence. That could result in much worse scenarios.
I'm understanding what you're saying. You're talking about another offense. Did you charge him with possession of illegal?
No, we did not.
Butterfly knife?
No, we did not.
I'm sorry. Now, what are you saying that the fact that it was a butterfly knife would somehow enhance the facts which go to the charge of terroristic threatening?
No, I'm not, Your Honor. I'm sorry if I was confusing in the way I answered the question. I'm just saying that there is an legal issue as that, okay, if this court or the ICA finds that such post, if the ICA finds as it did, or if this court finds that items that are not suppressible, if as a result of post, I guess, unlawful detention criminal acts, to what extent would that go to? And I guess there's another issue behind this issue that we're arguing right here. That's all I'm discussing. So, anyway, if you don't have any more questions, I'll.
Thank you. Mr. Jameson, anything further?
I'm sorry, no, I don't have time.
We'll give you a couple minutes.
Okay.
Thank you. Boy, it's embarrassing to be corrected about something I should have known. But he's absolutely right. Finding 13, Judge De Rosario, in fact, did not find that the knife was pointed specifically at the officer. Okay, so in our brief, we do argue on the last page that there was no crime here. We do say that. And when we argue that, we do argue that. Therefore, Kachanian and Lyon does not apply. I want to be clear. Let's not get hung up on whether or not those cases apply, because again, I stress they apply to unlawful responses, criminal responses. What's strange here is I don't know if we talk about suppressing, we always talk about suppressing evidence of crimes. We don't talk about suppressing evidence of non-crimes, So what's odd about this case is the court suppressed evidence of something that wasn't a crime, And I think that's what I was trying to make clear before this court and the findings that the judge made. He did, in fact, reject certain testimony. And if you looked at what we ended up with in his findings of fact, then we have something troubling before this court or any other court, I would submit. And that is a situation where a person is being held on what is essentially not criminal behavior. Maybe that may have influenced Judge De Rosario as to why I think the record does reflect that he did release this individual, though he was being held, unfortunately, on other matters. But that does somewhat suggest that may have been in the court's mind.
But counsel, in his oral ruling, he said that defendant was pointing the knife in the direction of Officer Miller. Does it not appear to be more of an inadvertent omission as opposed to a specific finding on that issue, given that he actually said so? I mean, he said that in his oral ruling.
Well, I suppose there's two ways of looking at that. One way is yes, you could say that. But on the other hand, one could also say that on reflection, before you sign this written order, the judge may have realized, no, this written order, which will stand for all time, is what I write, is what I adopt. This is what I find to have been the case.
Would you agree that if what he said in his oral ruling is in fact what his finding is, which is that the defendant pointed the knife at Officer Miller, that we would be looking at the case in a much different way from that which you're arguing, which would be, in fact, there would be an unlawful response, or at least the court found the basis for that?
By itself, respectfully, no.
A knife at a police officer's stomach is not unlawful?
It depends on how the stomach got there, I'm sorry, but if the officer is there and I point the knife and I go up to his stomach, maybe he should get shot. But if it's the officer who places his stomach in front of the knife, I don't know what to say. I mean, you know, there's a difference, certainly a clear distinction in how one would interpret the pointing of the knife. It's very difficult to say in the abstract whether something is or is not a threat.
Well, he was recapping the testimony, I guess, of the officer, right? That was the officer.
In the oral? Yes, that was the officer.
The other two, the employees, said they didn't see him to point the knife.
Right, and I think one even said that it was down at the side. And I believe the officer may have even somewhat contradicted himself, that not contradicted, but did explain at some point the knife was like this. And I, for the record, holding my hands more out to my side, the knife would still be canted some. And that word cant, I have to explain. I had to look up. I never used it in my life. When I saw it, I was like, what did this officer mean by cant? I'm happy to say when I found that, looked it up in the dictionary, it means simply to tilt something upward. And that is why it looked to me that if you can't see what's in somebody's hand and you ask them what's in your hand and they tilt the hand upward, now you can see what's in the hand. And there is something else I almost forgot to argue on. Hope I'm not being facetious, but to me, if an officer is about to grab, you could interpret what the officer did in this case, if from the eyes standpoint of the defendant, rapidly approaching him and look like he's about to grab a hand that is holding a sharp object. Who's to say the officer may not have cut his hand had he grabbed that knife, had he grabbed at the hand? So would it not be somewhat, I suppose, the right thing to do, maybe, to show him what's in your hand? Now, from the officer's standpoint, of course, I don't want to disparage law enforcement. They have a hard enough job. But the officer respectfully saw a thief going in that store, and when he encountered what was not unlawful conduct, saw somebody attacking him who in fact was not.
It's a difficult way to prove shoplifting or theft if you stop a person in the store rather than wait until he exits the store.
That's also troubling in this case because the man hadn't left the store yet. So generally speaking, if he had been shot, if he hadn't left the store, he could go to any of the counters, because this particular counter was closed. I think counter two is what we're talking about. We don't know what other counters were open, but we know counter two wasn't open. Besides, it's neither here nor there, respectfully, because in fact, he had nothing from the store. You know, but if he had been in the store with something he hadn't paid for, I would submit that's not shoplifting. It's not. Even if I would say he stuck it in his pocket, there's an open cash register and he's still in that store, who's to say he's not, he may have inadvertently forgotten it to pay, or he may decide which one is the better way, maybe he's taking a shortcut. I don't know the answer to that.
Also say he was afraid that a robbery might ensue?
Yes,
you
mentioned, but
robbery as well as shoplifting?
He did say that.
Okay.
He said
and the defendant in fact had a knife in his hand, right?
If he had seen the knife and then thought there was a robbery about to ensue, different case. But the law is real clear.
I'm not saying the police officer was right. Yeah. I'm just saying we can't exclude robbery, and you're talking only about shoplifting.
You can't exclude?
I mean, you're talking only about shoplifting, and so he could have gone to another register.
Oh, right.
But in fact, if he had a knife in his hand, he could have gone to a register to ask for money. He wouldn't necessarily had to have a product.
Yes.
On his person.
Time is up. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. I will take this matter under advisement.